Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Friday, January 6th, 2017. As I mentioned yesterday, I will be away for a couple of days attending my cousin's funeral on the East Coast. So no podcast Monday and Tuesday. Our next News and Comment podcast coming your way on Wednesday, January 11th. And the breaking news story today, a mass shooting, at least five people killed at the Fort Lauderdale, Florida airport. And I'll leave it to the corporate media to cover that event because they've got the resources to do it. I will add on a personal note that I've learned that my friends Chantal and Allison were transiting through the Fort Lauderdale airport. They were separated and locked down in different areas as the incident developed. But we got word that they're both okay and have been reunited, and I hope there are many other happy endings like that. Clearly, in a tragedy like this, not everybody will come away in that manner. Our second segment today will be focused on the Trump controversy over alleged Russian hacking and the results of his first major briefing by the top spooks about the issues. He's modified his position just a little bit. That's coming up in our second segment. But we open with the news from Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, where four Yemeni Guantanamo prisoners were transferred yesterday to a re-education camp in Saudi Arabia. Now, they're not actually being freed. They may ultimately be released from Saudi custody. But this is a kind of a compromised situation. Now, two of these men have been cleared for release since 2009. The other two were considered more dangerous, but were cleared for release by one of the periodic review boards over the last 6 months. And this now leaves, I think the count is somewhere in the 50s. And there are 15 or 16 on a list for transfer before January 20th. That would leave the population post-Obama at Guantanamo at around 39 prisoners. And this is a deep disappointment, as many of you know. We've got an incoming president who brags about wanting to reinstitute torture, who wants to put more bad dudes at Guantanamo. And he tweeted a couple of days ago on the 3rd of January that, and this, of course, is just so out of line. He's not the president. He has no basis to make this statement. But when you got an ego as big as Trump's, it doesn't stop you. He just flatly said there should be no further releases from Gitmo. Now, even after January 20th, he's not going to be the emperor. And I just find this an expression of grave ignorance. He went on to say, these are extremely dangerous people and should not be allowed back onto the battlefield. Well, there are about two dozen people who might be described as truly dangerous. Of course, they haven't been properly charged or tried. And so the nation that claims that justice is part of our signature hasn't managed in almost 15 years now to provide any form of accountability or transparent justice. And we know that the system is rigged and that people like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed will ultimately be convicted and executed. But we certainly haven't set any kind of an example as a nation of laws. And the bigger picture here, as I pointed out yesterday, is that President Obama fell for the campaign trope of promising on my first day of office, I'm going to do this. And we've seen the history of it. I recapped it briefly yesterday. Bill Clinton said he was going to allow gays to serve in the military, but was brushed back by members of his own party, and we were left with the awful compromise of don't ask, don't tell, which lingered for, what, 18 years. And I've used the example of Arnold Schwarzenegger, and he'll surface later, but he became governor of California through our recall process. And he had promised the voters he was going to blow up the car tax. And so he did. And it led to deficits throughout the term and a half that Schwarzenegger served as governor of California. And so the Republicans are now coming to grips with the downside of the promises that they've made to repeal Obamacare. And while the party is nominally unified, some defectors have surfaced. And one is Rand Paul, the kooky senator from Kentucky who ran for president last year. And I agree with Rand Paul on just a handful of issues. But he, I think, is speaking for many Republicans who are afraid to actually say this. He said, look, I want to see the replacement before I vote for repeal. If Congress fails to vote on a replacement at the same time as repeal, the repealers risk assuming the blame for the continued unraveling of Obamacare. And he's right about this, because the maneuvers that they need to take in order to dismantle Obamacare require them to use the budget process in the Senate that only requires a majority vote, 51, not the 60 votes to avoid a filibuster on most other types of legislation. But in the process of repeal, it could increase the government's debt by almost $10 trillion or over the next 10 years, or $1 trillion a year. Now, that, of course, flies in the face of the Republican deficit hawks. And even I am pretty astounded that you could add $10 trillion to the debt in such a short period of time. There are also the moderate senators, so-called, Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, Susan Collins of Maine, who have voted yes on these preliminary measures, but they express concerns about the rush to repeal without a replacement plan. Mr. Plaid, Alexander said, there are a number of things that need to be repealed, but I think what we need to focus on first is what we would replace it with, and what are the steps that it would take to do that? And how many people are you going to leave in the lurch? Susan Collins is concerned about 84,000 people in Maine. And in Nevada, Senator Dean Heller, Republican, is concerned about 187,000 people in that state who have picked up Obamacare. And this is a very serious issue. And the Republicans have pandered to the max. To the minority, it's some 40% of respondents to polls who say they hate Obamacare and they want it dumped. But the devil has surfaced here in the details of how that is actually achieved. And here's another lingering problem from political pandering. We know that North Carolina passed its bathroom bill, which, of course, demands that people use the restroom that appears, that is consistent with the listing of their gender on their birth certificate. So it's aimed at transgender persons or persons who are in the process of transitioning. And as we know, there are many people who think that, nasty things will go on in a bathroom if a man who's transitioning to female or a female who's transitioning to male uses the bathroom with which they identify. And the idea that they're going to threaten people with some sort of a sexual act is just so fallacious. And why is that? To me, it's pretty simple. That if I'm a male transitioning to female, and I go into the female bathroom, I'm not going to be interested in sex, predatory or otherwise, with a female, right? I'm identifying as a female, not as a lesbian, as a... And this is where the Bible thumpers really can't think clearly enough to figure this out. And now we have 8 states that are planning to try to pass bathroom bills in the coming year. Over in Texas, Dan Patrick, the lieutenant governor, a real knuckle-dragger, he said, you can mark today as the day that Texas has drawn a line in the sand and saying no. The privacy and safety of Texans is our first priority, not political correctness. So the other states that have introduced or pre-filed bills restricting access to bathrooms include Alabama, Kentucky, Missouri, South Carolina, Virginia, Washington, and Minnesota. So be prepared for more silly fights over bathroom access in the coming year. And here's a bizarre comment from Dan Patrick, who makes a linkage between, these kind of discriminatory bathroom laws and economic progress or success. He said, if you look at all the states in the country that have the most robust economies, they're states, almost without exception, that do not allow men into ladies' rooms. What the fuck? I mean, this is so irrational. He went on, but many of the states at the bottom of the pile where their economies are suffering have different policies. I'm sorry. I feel like I am living in an era where I'm watching other people lose touch with reality. And at a certain point, it has an impact where you question your own connection to reality. I'm not there yet, but I'm kind of feeling it. This is a tragic event that occurred in Chicago. And it is stupid. It's inexcusable. Four African-American youths, 18-year-old Jordan Hill, 18-year-old Tess Faye Cooper, 18-year-old Brittany Covington, and 23-year-old Tanisha Covington, are all being charged with hate crimes, including aggravated kidnapping, aggravated unlawful restraint, and aggravated battery with a deadly weapon. They spent time with a young white man identified as 18-year-old Austin Hillborn, who is apparently retarded or otherwise not a fully functional person. And they hung out with him, and then they got into some sort of a dispute with him. And so they started to treat him very badly. They abused him. They tied him up, made him sit in a corner. And then this is what is so bizarre. They live streamed it on Facebook. And the levels of stupidity involved not only in the original crimes, but then the idea that, oh yeah, we're going to share this with all our friends on Facebook. So in one of the videos, Cooper and Hill can be seen threatening the white man Hillborn with a knife until he gets on his knees and says, "Fuck Donald Trump." Then he kisses the floor. Another video shows him being forced to drink from a toilet. And authorities said his diminished mental capacity, the fact that they tied him up, the obvious racial quotes that they posted live on Facebook, taken the totality of the circumstances, the state's attorney has agreed to try these or pursue these as hate crimes. Facebook has removed the video, saying that we do not allow people to celebrate or glorify crimes on Facebook, and have removed the original video for this reason. And you can't get in the minds of kids. I can tell you that when I was 12 or 13, I operated in a slightly abusive manner. I took advantage of a neighbor boy named Scott Hoxby, and I was able to persuade him to eat dirt. And I only mention this because I think there is an element of this as just kids will be kids. Boys will be boys. But that doesn't excuse any of this. And the idea that they would put it on Facebook is just so crazy. During the holidays, I put up a post on Facebook. And while I have misgivings about many aspects of the social media platform, I appreciate that, for example, Facebook Live brought me incredible coverage of Standing Rock from indie media reporters who turned on their phones and showed us what was going on. And I appreciate that. But in that same post, I said that there are some people who are stupid enough to put their own crimes, blunders, and stupidity up there for everyone to see. The other day, I reported that Kamala Harris, who is the new freshman senator from California, who just stepped down as our state's attorney general, she was the subject of an article at The Intercept written by David Dayan. And he did a good job of exposing the issue about One West. This is a company that was controlled by Steven Mnuchin. And Mnuchin is Donald Trump's nominee to be Secretary of the Treasury. He was CEO of this bank and mortgage company from 2009 to 2015, when they were one of the top and most prodigious foreclosure acts in the nation. And in his original article, Dan pointed out that the Attorney General's office had investigated, found over 1,000 violations of foreclosure laws, said that further investigation would uncover many more incidents. But then the investigation was closed. And yesterday, Kamala Harris made some rather bland and dismissive comments about this. When asked about it, she said, "Well, it's a decision my office made. We went and we followed the facts and the evidence, and it's a decision my office made. We pursued it just like any other case. We go and we take a case wherever the facts lead us." Well, her refusal or decision not to pursue further investigation against One West and Mnuchin could be used by her fellow senators to say, there's nothing there, just ignore this. But there are activist groups, including the Root Strikers, the Center for Popular Democracy's Fed Up campaign, and the California Reinvestment Coalition, are calling for a delay of Mnuchin's confirmation hearing until he publicly discloses all settlements and lawsuits that One West has faced from its foreclosure-related activities. And I hope that occurs. But what we're seeing is that Mitch McConnell has scheduled the confirmation hearings back-to-back and multiple going on at the same time. And then there's a Trump news conference, the first one in over 6 months, that's scheduled for next week. And all of that is going to make it very difficult for senators to attend all of these confirmation hearings and hold accountable the appointees that Trump has put forward. It's going to be messy. And it remains to be seen if the Democrats have the balls and the strategy to deny confirmation to even a single one of Trump's almost exclusively white, rich guys who will populate his cabinet. Good news for New Yorkers. Governor Cuomo and the state have announced a deal with Entergy to shut down the Indian Point nuclear power plant by 2021. The first unit will be shut down in 2020, and the other has to close by April of 2021. That's about the same timeline for the shutdown of Diablo Canyon, the last remaining nuclear power plant in California. And I consider this to be good news, because nuclear power plants produce nuclear waste that we don't know what to do with, and the Fukushima meltdown is really the classic evidence of the real dangers of nuclear power operation. And just the other night, there was a science story on the PBS NewsHour about how people like Bill Gates are promoting a new generation of nuclear generation facilities that use different technology. It's not water-cooled. But the same issue about nuclear waste and the probable problem with cost overruns will afflict those structures as well. The Trump transition team has announced a very rude gesture. They have notified all of the political appointees to ambassadorships under the Obama administration that their service will be terminated at about the time Trump takes the oath of office on January 20th. Now, typically, they replace these ambassadors one by one, and it gives the outgoing ambassador time to relocate and move the family and deal with all kinds of other issues. Now, the whole ambassadorship system is corrupt, and Obama sold ambassadorships just like every other president before him has. And we know Trump is going to do the same. But to treat these people so rudely is just another indication of the arrogance of Donald J. Trump. And is this a distraction or just the ego that cannot be controlled? I referenced Donald Trump and Arnold Schwarzenegger at the beginning of this podcast. Schwarzenegger has taken over as the host of The Apprentice television show, which is still executive produced by Donald J. Trump. Now, it's silly that Trump holds on to this title. It shouldn't be legal for the president to hold two jobs. But I guess we forgot to pass a law like that. And so we have this bizarre scene where Arnold Schwarzenegger, the failed governor of California who got elected because he was a celebrity, is nominally working for the celebrity who has been elected president. And Trump is pissing on his own property. He tweeted, as usual, While the ratings are in and Arnold Schwarzenegger got swamped or destroyed by comparison to the ratings machine, referring to himself by his initials, DJT, so much for being a movie star, and that was season 1 compared to season 14. Now compare him to my season 1. But who cares? He supported Kasich and Hillary. Now, this just shows the bizarre way that Donald Trump's mind works. And maybe he was using this to distract from the obvious news about the meeting with the spooks that we're going to cover here in just a moment, or maybe other embarrassing issues. But to me, what is rich in the irony of Schwarzenegger replacing Trump but working for Trump is that Arnold really, I think, embodies the downside of a celebrity elected official. And nobody really refers to him as the former governor of California. He's just the former weightlifter, steroid user, groper, and action movie star. Every day I like to pause for a second to thank all the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast. People like Billy Cook, Mark Brodsky, Dick Attlee, Jeffrey Stewart. They're all monthly subscribers, and you can join them, too. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click the menu button, pull it down, click Become a Subscriber. It takes you to the sign-up page. Have you seen the bonus book there for a new annual subscriber? I have just a few copies of the Robbie Robertson memoir about his life in the band. It's called Testimony, and it's yours for the asking. I'm also continuing my effort to clear out my garage at home. I culled hundreds of books from my library over the weekend, and there's a listener, I won't embarrass her, but she emailed, yeah, you know, I'm working on the same problem, trying to reduce the number of books I have. So what I decided to do is see if listeners would like to help me reduce the number of books in my library and make a contribution to the Peter B. Collins Podcast. So in honor of the new Cold War that we have started with Russia, I have a book, and let's see, this is published in the early 90s by Max Frankel, who at that point was the immediate former editor of the New York Times. And he signed my book in 2004. He says, for Peter Collins, with gratitude and respect, Max Frankel. The book is called High Noon in the Cold War, Kennedy, Khrushchev, and the Cuban Missile Crisis. And if you'd like to add this to your library, just shoot me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com, and we will do a little business here. I'm asking for $100 or more to help increase revenues here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast as I try to empty out some of the older books in my library. And now, welcome to part two of my daily news and comment podcast. This is Peter B. Collins. It is Friday, January 6, 2016. And this is the day that Donald Trump finally met with top officials from the intelligence community and the director of the FBI. The subject was being briefed on the report that they just gave to President Obama. This is about a 50-page report which purports to prove that Russia intentionally tried to interfere with our elections, that Russia hacked the DNC servers, and then fed that information somehow to WikiLeaks, and that that was used to manipulate the outcome of our election. As you know, I'm highly skeptical about these claims. I have yet to see any evidence, and as of this hour, it hasn't changed. Now, after that two-hour meeting, Donald J. Trump issued a statement, and what's a real relief is that it wasn't a tweet. Let me quote. In a statement issued after the president-elect was briefed by senior American intelligence and law enforcement officials, Trump said, quote, "While Russia, China, other countries, outside groups, and people are consistently trying to break through the cyber infrastructure of our governmental institutions, businesses, and organizations, including the Democrat National Committee, there was absolutely no effect on the outcome of the election, including the fact that there was no tampering whatsoever with voting machines." Now, here we have Trump, who loves these superlatives. Absolutely no effect on the outcome of the election. Now, what does he base that on? There's no citation here that I learned a lot from the report. They explained things to me that I didn't know before. Nothing like that. He is simply doubling down on the position that he held in general before this meeting. And despite that, the New York Times headlined this, "After security meeting, Trump admits possibility of Russian hacking." Well, his statement doesn't quite go there. And then this final part we're going to delve into in a moment. "Including the fact," his statement says, "that there was no tampering whatsoever with voting machines." I don't actually believe Russia messed with our voting machines because we have Americans who do that. And again, we'll get into that a little bit further in a couple of minutes. So before the meeting, Trump called the New York Times, spoke to a reporter there by phone, and he said that this is a witch hunt. He said, "China relatively recently hacked 20 million government names. How come nobody even talks about that? This is a political witch hunt." And so, as you know, I'm pretty uncomfortable being on the same side of this issue as Trump. And I don't hold the same arguments or rationale for being skeptical of the intelligence assertions. Yesterday, Jimmy Clapper said, "Our assessment is even more resolute now about Russian hacking." And all of this is constructed in ways where there is no evidence. It's all inferred. It's all believed. And we all believe the same things here. Well, I don't. And as I mentioned yesterday, whether Trump knows this or not, his stance toward the intelligence community on this issue is confronting the deep state. And we saw senators of both parties almost unanimously praise the intelligence officials yesterday and align themselves with the spooks against Trump. And that's why I find this so interesting and complex. This is not a, you know, kind of one-level set of issues. So in that phone interview this morning, Trump noted there have been prior successful hackings of the White House and Congress, suggesting it's unfair that those attacks on American institutions haven't received the attention that the Russians have. But none of the information from those intrusions was made public, as it was in the case of the hacking of the Democratic National Committee and John Podesta, Hillary Clinton's campaign chairman. Trump, "With all that being said, I don't want countries to be hacking our country. They've hacked the White House. They've hacked Congress. We're like the hacking capital of the world." And then he shifts to his insecurities, and he has to boast. "They've gotten beaten very badly in the election. I won more counties in the election than Ronald Reagan. They are very embarrassed about it. To some extent, it's a witch hunt. They just focus on this." And then he noted that the New York Times and other major media outlets were skunked yesterday by the scrappy little outfit called BuzzFeed. BuzzFeed reported that the FBI had never even examined the servers at the Democratic National Committee. So Trump said the DNC wouldn't let them see the servers. How can you be sure about hacking when you can't even get to the servers? The DNC has previously said, news narrative. The DNC has previously said that the law enforcement agency had not asked to examine the computers. Then Trump got a little pissed. And we'll tell you about that, but first we'll explain why. The Washington Post and NBC last night, based on leaks of the report to Obama that occurred after the briefing of the president at the White House on Thursday. There are two separate leaks here. One to the Washington Post that was picked up by NBC stated that senior officials in the Russian government celebrated Trump's victory over Clinton as a geopolitical win for Moscow. Now, once again, this is based entirely on anonymous official leakers inside the intelligence or political establishment in Washington, and it comes with no attribution and, once again, zero evidence. At least they're consistent about that. And this is based on intercepts of some communications, but we don't know where they came from. And, of course, it's unattributed, and it could be pure fiction, written by screenwriters at the Langley headquarters of the CIA. The Post goes on, other key pieces of information gathered by U.S. spy agencies include the identification of actors involved in delivering stolen Democratic emails to the WikiLeaks website, and disparities in the levels of effort Russian intelligence entities devoted to Democratic or Republican campaign networks. That's one of the indicators they're saying, well, gosh, they didn't release any dirt on Republicans. Well, that is speculative at best, and it isn't proof of anything. So then the Post continues, those and other data points are at the heart of an unprecedented intelligence report being circulated in Washington this week that details the evidence, it says, of Russian interference in the presidential campaign. There's no evidence. There is still no evidence. It's all trust me. And I don't trust James Clapper or John Brennan or James Comey to tell us the truth. They can change that by providing evidence. They're going to release an unclassified version of the report, maybe as soon as later today or on Monday. But once again, there's going to be no evidence in it. And so our intelligence community claims high confidence. They've claimed 100% confidence at some points about these sets of assertions. And Obama imposed sanctions on Russia a week before this report was actually presented to him. Doesn't that raise any red flags for you? And buried deep in this Washington Post story, it says, there are no major new bombshell disclosures even in the classified report. So we're being played in a big way. And there are so many people who buy into this without skepticism, without demanding proof, without challenging these cumulative assertions and the buttressing of one media outlet's reports by saying, oh yeah, they reported what we reported too, so that makes it true. So as a result of this, Trump, who apparently doesn't read the Washington Post or didn't know that the Post first reported this stuff, he tweeted this morning. He said, I'm asking the chairs of the House and Senate committees to investigate top secret intelligence shared with NBC prior to me seeing it. Again, his ego enters the fray here. And, these are the kinds of leaks that he better get used to, because that's how Washington works. So they claim that they have identified the actors, right? Reuters also has separately published this, quote, the CIA has identified Russian officials who fed material hacked from the Democratic National Committee and party leaders to WikiLeaks at the direction of Russian President Vladimir Putin through third parties, according to a new U.S. intelligence report. Again, these are assertions. And the idea that they can finger Putin by saying, as Obama did, well, you know, not much happens in Russia without approval from the top dog. That's not proof. That's speculation. That's belief. And it may be accurate, but no one has proved it to me. So they're saying they have the names, right? Let's take a look at a woman whose name showed up on Obama's sanctions list issued a week ago. Her name is Alisa Shevchenko. And what's interesting is they didn't put her on the list using her own name. They listed companies that she operated that are no longer in business. Now, that raises questions on the accuracy of the information they have, on how current that information is. But Alisa Shevchenko, who is a fairly high-profile young Russian hacker known for working with companies to find vulnerabilities in their systems. She's a specialist on day one vulnerabilities. When new software is released, she goes through it looking for those vulnerabilities to help her client companies tighten them up. So her companies were listed there, and she's defiant. She decried the insane level of hysteria around the entire, quote, Russian hacking, unquote, story. She suggested that U.S. authorities are guilty either of a technically incompetent misinterpretation of the facts or had been fooled by a counterfeit in order to frame my company. Those who could have had an interest in framing her could include competitors, U.S. intelligence, Russian intelligence, or others, Shevchenko said. A young female hacker and her helpless company seems like a perfect pick for that goal. I don't try to hide. I travel a lot. I'm a friendly, communicative person. And most importantly, I don't have any big money, power, or connections behind me to shrug off the blame. So, really, it could be anyone. She formerly worked for Kaspersky Lab, one of the best-known Russian cybersecurity firms. Then she started her own shop. And as I mentioned, both of the companies she started have been shut down, and those are the companies that we listed on the blacklist being subject to American sanctions. Somebody's got some explaining to do. But Ms. Shevchenko said that she's turned down plenty of offers of work on ideological grounds. I never work with douchebags. I only work with honest and open people that I feel good about. Asked directly if she'd ever worked on a government contract in any capacity, she said, not that I know of. And yesterday, the scene in the Senate, I got to watch some of it on television last night, was really comical. As you saw, Republicans and Democrats try to outdo each other in kissing the asses of the Director of National Intelligence, who lied to those senators point blank under oath just a couple of years ago. And now they're embracing him and all of this speculative information as a way of trying to diminish the influence of the incoming president. And so it's amazing to me that they go through all of these maneuvers. And we saw yesterday that Jim Woolsey, the former CIA director who'd been advising the Trump campaign, abruptly stepped down, said, I'm out of here as of right now. We don't know if that's significant or exactly what prompted it. But there is one set of exchanges that I want to credit Roger Shuler for taking a look at. Roger, of course, is the reporter from used to live in Alabama and is exposed at his legal schnauzer blog, The Corruption in Alabama Politics and the Judicial System there. And while I don't agree with Roger, who does buy into the Russian hacking claim, nevertheless, he raises an important question. He cites an exchange between John McCain and James Clapper regarding whether Russia actually succeeded in manipulating the vote count anywhere in the United States. And McCain was eager to deny this, even as he was asking Clapper for his opinion. So McCain says, what you're talking about is if they succeeded in changing the results of an election, which none of us believes they were. All right, and then Clapper said, they did not change any vote tallies or anything of that sort. And we heard Trump say that there was no change whatsoever. Here's the quote. There was no tampering whatsoever with voting machines. Now, I think this is a fascinating set of denials because I believe that there was manipulation. And I'm going to do an interview in the next few weeks with Bob Fetrakis, who wrote a report about the attempted recounts in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. There was manipulation of the vote count in Wisconsin and likely in Michigan. And it wasn't done by Russians. It was done by Americans, most likely acting in concert with the Trump campaign. And we know in the primaries, election results were manipulated to favor Hillary Clinton. So we don't need to blame Russia for the obvious failings in our own internal systems. Thanks for joining me for my News and Comment podcast, part one all the way through, or just part two. It's always your choice. And this podcast is available daily on YouTube.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.